Okay, that will do. Thank you so much. I want to draw your attention, if you don't mind, to Philippians chapter 1, verse 12. And we'll read a section there. Paul is talking to the Philippians about what has been happening to him and how he perceives it. Now, I want you to know, brothers and sisters, that what has happened to me has actually served to advance the gospel. As a result, it has become clear throughout the whole palace guard and to everyone else that I am in chains for Christ. And because of my chains, most of the brothers and sisters have become confident in the Lord and dare all the more to proclaim the gospel without fear. It is true that some preach Christ out of envy and rivalry, but others out of goodwill. The latter do so out of love, knowing that I am put here for the defence of the gospel. The former preach Christ out of selfish ambition, not sincerely, supposing that they can stir up trouble for me while I am in chains. But what does it matter? The important thing is that Christ is preached. And because of this, I rejoice. And I will continue to rejoice. And I know that through your prayers and God's provision of the Spirit of Jesus Christ, what has happened to me will turn out for my deliverance. I eagerly expect and hope that I will in no way be ashamed, but will have sufficient courage so that now, as always, Christ will be exalted in my body, whether by life or by death. For to me, to live is Christ, and to die is gain. If I am to go on living in the body, this will mean fruitful labour for me. Yet what shall I choose? I do not know. I am torn between the two. I desire to depart and be with Christ, which is better by far. But it is more necessary for you that I remain in the body. Convinced of this, I know that I will remain. And I will continue with all of you for your progress and joy in the faith, so that through my being with you again, your boasting in Christ Jesus will abound on account of me. Amen. God always blesses the public reading of his inspired and his infallible word. So last night I said I wanted to take four pit stops around this chandelier of joy and stop and reflect on it. And this is the first one. And I want to think with you for a moment about how we redeem the trial, how we dignify the trial that we are going through. And I guess in order to do that, we have to stop and have a bit of a reflection together on whether or not we have an adequate understanding of the role and the place of suffering and sorrow and heartbreak in our lives. The end of the church from which I was birthed and in which I stand is the charismatic and Pentecostal end, and we have a woefully absent theology of suffering. And as a consequence, when suffering and sorrow hits the life of a believer, they are, in that tradition, they don't know what to do. Partly because I think one of the great dangers of the tradition or the tribe, that of the bit of the church of which I am part, is that we have allowed false gospel teaching and wrong understanding to infiltrate too much of our view of life. So it isn't unusual if you pick up a magazine from the charismatic end of the church to see a health and a wealth and a prosperity message coming at you from various different contexts. If you turn on one of the religious channels that are beamed from the UK or from Israel or from the United States, you are almost certain within a few minutes to hear a sermon about how you claim your healing, how you walk in the blessing of God, how you live with prosperity. I don't any longer, I'm the theologian in residence of it now, but I led a network called Spring Harvest for a number of years. And we had our own challenges around this. The New Wine Network has its challenges around this. We are not good in the bit of the church that I am from at identifying and helping people to think about the life that they have rather than this idealized life that we often promise them. One of the challenges of that is that we end up making our gospel call a transaction rather than a surrender. And that's a problem. If I want to fill the church that I lead in Belfast, I can fill it within a matter of weeks or months simply by telling people that they come and claim their healing, they come and claim this and they come and claim that. And I will fill the church. The problem is that when those people face life, when they face the uncertainties of sorrow and sadness and loss, they will just as quickly leave again. Or worse, they will become antagonistic toward a gospel that they were told, promised them that they would never suffer. And then they end up suffering. So before I can look at Philippians, I just have to kind of remind you, without being aggressive, I hope, or rude, I hope, that actually to be a Christian is to embrace a life of suffering. You can't avoid it. When Paul wrote to Timothy, he wanted him to understand that. And he said, very, very simply, in 2 Timothy chapter 3, verse 12, those who seek to live a godly life will suffer. There is no way round that passage. It doesn't mean some of you will. It doesn't mean the occasional person will. That's how this rolls. There is a remarkable thing that happens in the Gospels, particularly in the Gospel of Mark. If you want to understand in English literature, it's often said that a book will be a success if it has a really good beginning and a great ending. The middle can be a bit questionable at times. In Hebrew literature, it's the other way around. If you want to understand the core message of a Hebrew writer, you look at the middle of the text, because that's where they will place the significant kind of ideas that they have. So, for example, the middle of John's gospel, you will all know this, but John takes three quarters of his gospel in physical length, deals with 1 week of Jesus' life. And the pivot point in the book is in John chapter 13, where we are told of Jesus washing the disciples' feet, knowing that his time had come and knowing that all things had been entrusted to him by his Father, got up from the table, took a towel and a basin and began to wash the feet of the disciples. In Mark's gospel, the middle is interesting. There are no verses in the original text. In fact, there are no spaces between letters in the original text, between words. They just are, and they're all in capitals. There's just one long list of letters in the original Greek text. I don't know if you've ever seen one. It is remarkable. It's like looking at an alphabetical Sudoku. It is so, it's amazing. And trying to work with those texts is fascinating. I do that a little bit. But so there are no verses or chapters in the gospel, in any of the New Testament, or the Old for that matter. But in Mark's gospel, the middle is the end of chapter 8 and the beginning of chapter 9. You can't have, it's not just the beginning of chapter 9, it's not just the end of chapter 8. It is the end of chapter 8 and the beginning of chapter 9. That is the fulcrum at the centre of Mark's gospel upon which the whole thing pivots. So I hope this will help you understand what I'm trying to say. Imagine for a moment that whatever that says is the centre of Mark's gospel. And it's balanced, by the way, on either side, if you're interested in kind of linguistics and how these books are written. In chapter 1, with Mark declaring, this is the gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. That phrase, the Son of God, appears in the opening remarks of Mark's gospel. And then you come all the way along the seesaw, which is resting on this fulcrum, we'll come back to that in a minute. And you go to the very end of Mark's gospel, and you have the centurion standing at the foot of the cross, watching the crucified Christ breathing his last. And he says, surely, this man is the Son of God. So there's the balancing weights on either side of Mark's gospel, which is amazing, isn't it? These powerful declarations by Mark, probably, and the young man that ran away naked from the upper room, and almost certainly Peter's gospel articulated through Mark, who was his amanuensis, his secretary. And at the end you have this Gentile Roman spectator declaring, surely this man was the Son of God. And it all rests on this fulcrum. And this fulcrum in the middle of Mark's gospel is the story of the Transfiguration, where James, John and Peter are brought up a mountainside and they encounter Christ, who hasn't changed one bit ontologically in that moment, by the way. It's not like Christ becomes someone that he isn't in the moment of transfiguration. His essence never changes. It's just that they get to see it for a moment. Like a curtain being drawn back so that you can see into his soul. You see his iridescent essence. He is the Son of God. He's talking with Moses and with Elijah. In Luke's version of that account, we're told that he is talking about his exodus, his departure, which is the word that is used to describe the Israelite journey from Egypt into the promised land. And they are mesmerized by it. They are fascinated by it. And Peter says, let's just stay here. Let's stay in this moment of encounter. Good Pentecostal Peter was. Let's just stay here. And Jesus says, immediately after, if anyone would come after me, they must take up, immediately before, if anyone must come up, will come after me, they must take up their cross and follow me. If you're not willing to take up the cross, you will never be able to encounter the glory of God. And that sense of embracing the life that God calls us to is the only thing that will lead us into an encounter with him, which is more profound than you could ever begin to express. The sense of a calling to not embrace suffering, not celebrate it, but to recognize it and work out how you respond to it is a fundamental part of what it is to be a disciple of Jesus. So I guess I want to ask you a question. What is your theology of suffering? What's your spiritual approach to it? I'm asking you to think about that. Is it something you just think, well, we just have to get through it and out the other side? We have to endure it. I'm not sure that that is enough. I think we have to work out a way of standing in the midst of the trial with a sense of triumph. Stand in the midst of sorrow with a sense of the shimmering presence of God with us, whether we feel him or not. And I'm not just talking about feelings, I'm not talking about emotions, I'm not talking about the kind of softer end, nothing wrong with those things, by the way, of our lives. I'm talking about a worldview, a perspective, a lens that can look at life and be able to stand in the midst of the darkest circumstances and flourish. That's what Paul has. And I think it's remarkable. I remember years ago reading the biography, I just had become a Christian, of Richard Wurmbrand. Do you remember Richard Wurmbrand? Tortured for Christ. Any of you read that book? Remarkable book. And in it he says something. I remember the sentence. Alone, cold, and hungry in my cell, comma. What could the next line be? I danced for joy in the presence of God. I mean, who writes that? He goes on to say that in his imprisonment, he knew that the guards enjoyed beating them when they sang or spoke of Christ. And they enjoyed singing and speaking of Christ. And he said, so therefore we were all happy. They beat us, we sang. That is not the default spiritual position of most Western or North American Christians. And that's a problem. Unless we have a theology of suffering, a spirituality that will guide us through the difficult points of our lives, we will never be able to flourish as believers. One of my great theological heroes, I wish I had got to meet him. I've read all of his books and listened to his lectures and I'm fascinated by him, is Francis Schaeffer. And Schaeffer writes about, in one of his books called The Bible and Art, which is about the Bible and art. He talks about, toward the end of it, learning the Bible and culture, learning to live, learning to understand that life is lived in a major and in a minor key. Now, he makes it very clear in his book that he's not talking about music. He's talking about the conflicts and the questions and the anxieties and the pressures of life alongside the joys and the celebrations of it. But I have reflected on that metaphor for many years. And actually, I want to push it a little further and suggest that what Schaeffer did, as he did so often, was speak prophetically in a way that even he could not see would impact the church that followed him. We do live in the major and the minor key. And our lives are written in two keys. We have a major key of celebration, of joy, of thanksgiving, of answered prayer, of yeses to our prayers, of blessings, of communion, of community, of celebrate, all of those things. But there is also a key change in our lives which involves us living in the underbelly of the absence of God. A sense of him not being present. Working out what you do when you feel like you are trapped in a darkened room and you don't know your way out. Crying to him and hearing nothing back and then having well-meaning Christians saying, well, God always answers prayer. He either says yes, no, or wait. And your response wants to be, that isn't the most helpful thing to say to me right now. I know that may be true, but can I not just sit in the uncertainty of this moment? I last night I was a little bit vulnerable with you. I'm always really nervous about that. I might not look it, but I am. Because I know immediately I'm going to have a dozen people wanting to pray for my inner healing. I'm fine. I don't mean that I am completely right, because none of us are. But I'm in a process like you of being healed by God's grace and mercy. He is stripping back one layer at a time my life. And occasionally other people are drawn into that story and I'm grateful for it. But when somebody says to you, sometimes I wonder where God is, it isn't an indication that they're having a faith crisis. It's an indication that they are talking honestly about the faith that they hold. And they sometimes need you just to listen, rather than to immediately become a Christianized version of the Oracle of Delphi to them and tell them all the things that they need to fix. A theology of suffering deals with that. It learns what it is to live, to have a symphony of life which has both a major and a minor key. And some of you will be in a minor key this morning and some of you will be in a major key. Paul, in Philippians chapter 1, seems to be bouncing out of one and into the other. He has this remarkable capacity to reflect God's joy in the midst of sorrow, God's strength in the midst of weaknesses that he is facing. In the words of one American author, he is like a steel magnolia. He has this rod of resilience down his spiritual spine that holds him no matter what. And it is remarkable. The only other person I see with that, and of course he has it perfectly, is the Lord Jesus. And here in Philippians 1, there are fundamentally only two lessons that I want to leave with you about this whole question. How Paul deals with his issue of uncertainty, sorrow, suffering, struggle, challenge. I think he does two things. First of all, he remembers that he is part of a community of faith. And secondly, he sees his trial through God's lens. Now let me unpack that for you. If you go to the beginning of the chapter, from verses 3 down to 11, you hear Paul saying, I thank God every time I remember you in all my prayers for all of you. I always pray with joy because of your partnership in the gospel from the first day until now. Being confident of this, that he who began a good work in you will carry it on to completion. It is right for me to feel this way about all of you, since I have you in my heart. And whether I am in chains or defending and confirming the gospel, all of you share in God's grace with me. God can testify how I long for all of you with the affection of Christ Jesus. I said last night, just for those of you that weren't here last night, Paul is almost certainly imprisoned in Rome whilst writing this. He may have been in prison in Ephesus, but I think he was probably in Rome when writing this. So here you have this man, and we'll see in the second half of the chapter that we'll look at in a moment, facing a profoundly uncertain future. And yet, in the midst of that uncertainty, his focus is on the saints with whom he has been ministering and whom he has a love for. You can read of the story of the establishment of the church in Philippi in Acts chapter 16, where Paul and Silas are in prison after having preached the gospel to Lydia, who was at a prayer meeting. And there is a riot and they are imprisoned. And then there's an earthquake. He's released. Well, he doesn't leave, but the doors open. And he and Silas remain in prison. The Philippian jailer is converted. He and his household, which would have been anybody over 11, are baptized, and the church in Philippi is founded. And now as he's writing back, he's remembering their partnership with him in the gospel. And he wants them to know that he's praying for them, but he's also grateful for their prayers. He recognizes the importance of Christian community. He's in prison, but he's praying for them. Verses 3 to 4 make that clear. He has a sense of being with them and of longing for them in verse 8. His language is not simply the clinical language of a distant pastoral overseer or a theologian trying to reflect from some kind of cultural ivory tower. He knows they hold him in their hearts. His language is of intimacy, of connectedness, of joined upness. He speaks of sharing in verse 5. He says in verse 6, you hold me in your heart. He also says in verse 6, you share in God's grace with me. There is this deep sense for him that Christian life is lived in community. We lose that too. And I sometimes wonder whether our sorrows and our suffering and our lack of theology around it is at least in some ways dependent on this sense of isolation that we often feel as believers. I don't know about you. Probably it wouldn't be true of Paul, I should think. It might have been, I don't know. But I know in my life there have been seasons when I have not known or not been able to pray. I just have entered a season when so much sorrow or sadness or uncertainty has gathered around me that my prayer life has ended up being nothing but groanings and utterings that cannot be expressed. But the saints of God are praying for me in that moment. And it is a humbling thing to realize that your faith, your life is being carried by others' prayers. I'm walking at the minute with a young man in our church. His name is Joel. And on November the 7th last year, he was 15 at the time. He was on his way home from school and he fell into a hedge talking gobbledygook. The following day, he was diagnosed with a brain tumour on the back of his head the size of a grapefruit. And they removed it on the 9th of November in a 16-hour operation. And 20 minutes later, he had a stroke. So he went back into hospital again for surgery for another 9 hours. And he is now 16. And he's learning how to walk again and talk again. He can't stand up on his own. He is able to communicate. His left eye doesn't work. His right ear has lost all hearing. His right side is weak. His mum, when he was 2, fought cancer. And for 6 months, I visited him every day. And now I visit him 3 or 4 times a week. And do very spiritual things. We play Uno Extreme. Or this game with circles that he always beats me on, which irritates me. And there were days that I came out of seeing Joel and sat in my car and beat my steering wheel and just needed to scream and get it out of my system and then leave it with the Lord. I said to him in the middle of when he began to have movement again, I said, Joel, how are you? And he's given me permission to share these stories. How are you doing? How are you and God doing? And he just looked at me and said, how do you think? And I said, well, are you angry at him? He said, yes. And I said, well, what do you want to do with that? He said, if he was here, I'd hit him. So I leaned into him and said, hit me instead. And he beat my chest with his left arm. Is that my left hand? My left hand, his left arm, for about 5 minutes and then stopped. Sometimes we need to give people space to do that. And we don't need to give them all the theological answers that they already know. They just need space. But here's the remarkable thing. 700,000 people a day are now praying for him. The Church of Jesus Christ has gathered round this young man and his family and carried him. Our church has been making meals for that family for a year. We do it with anybody. We had somebody who died yesterday morning. Immediately, we make them meals for a month. There's somebody who visits them every week. And I have to say to you, from a missional perspective, the most significant thing that God has used in the years of my ministry in mission is the suffering that people have gone through. It has been more impacting than all of the evangelistic campaigns we have run, all of the crusades, all of the outreaches, just the world looking at how a church behaves when it goes through sorrow and loss. And how we love one another has by far resulted in more people coming to faith in Jesus Christ than anything else we have ever done. Why then do we run away from it? Why don't we have a theology that addresses it? Why aren't we working this out so that the world could look at us and say, as they did in the early church, see how these Christians love one another? Paul survives in the midst of his sorrow and his difficulty and his challenge because he has a profound understanding of being part of a community of faith. He knows that even when he's in jail, he's not there alone. He may be surrounded by only Roman soldiers, but he is not alone. So often when we go through sorrow and trial, we think we are isolated, we think we are cut off, or we cut ourselves off from the community of faith. What Paul says in Romans 12:15 is that we weep together, we rejoice together, we do life together. It strikes me that this is one of the fundamental definitions of the New Testament church. I sometimes get cross when I hear people saying, we want to go back to the New Testament church. You really don't. Every letter written was written for an issue of division or hassle or theological difficulty. It wasn't this perfect establishment that had everything right. They fought, they misunderstood. Paul called some of them dogs and told them they should castrate themselves in this letter. I mean, I'm not sure you can handle that from a pastor. Do you know what you need to do? All you fellas, you need to go and castrate yourself. I don't think you would say that was the loving thing to do. But underneath it was this community who loved each other, who held each other, who carried one another, who supported one another, who bore one another's burdens. Every general epistle has something about that. So actually, for all saints for a moment, let me ask a question. Do you have a theology of suffering? Not just individually, but what do you do as a church to hold each other up when somebody goes through a valley? How do you love them? Now, I guess you may not be that type of congregation because you might be very eclectic. I don't know. If you are drawn together by language rather than location, that's difficult. If you have different social contexts, if you have different spiritualities, if you're like many churches that I know, when some people like one kind of spirituality and some people like another kind of spirituality, it can be hard to work out how do you support each other. But do you know what? When you suffer, you will find the most remarkable thing. It doesn't matter whether you speak in tongues or not. It doesn't matter whether you raise your hands or keep them by your side. It doesn't matter whether you have a secret book of common prayer strapped to your thigh. Or you will only sing songs that have been written in the last 5 months. Suffering doesn't stop and think, well, okay, are you charismatic? Are you Catholic? Are you Anglican? Are you? What are you? It just hits you. And in that moment, what we need is a community that loves us. Paul's redemption of the trial was at least in part because of this understanding that he wasn't in it alone and that he didn't have to cope with it alone. In my own journey, the people of God have picked me up and carried me. They have loved me. They have prayed for me. They have put up with me. They have listened to me. I mean that genuinely. At one point in the midst of all of the last few years, one of the impacts of profound trauma, post-traumatic stress actually, is a deep sense of memory loss that goes again, but it pops up and goes away and pops up and goes away. Now, this is going to sound funny to you, but it wasn't funny to me. There were two moments in my life that I remembered from that, still now, that remind me of the grace of God. One morning at our breakfast table in Buckinghamshire, we were sitting on a Saturday morning having brunch together. And I looked at my wife, Debbie, and I looked at our four children, and I thought, I know you're my children, but I can't remember what you're called. And then one Christmas in an Advent sermon, the great preacher, you know, I'm standing in the pulpit preaching from the Gospel of Mark about hope. And I forgot what Jesus was called. And I could find myself getting toward the point where I had to use his name. And in my head I said, Lord, I love you. But I can't remember what your son's called. And the congregation just smiled. And loved me through it. Because when you know that you're part of a community, when you know that you have their love and their support, then the trial becomes bearable and something beautiful begins to emerge out of it. The second thing that we see here is our need to see the trial through the lens of God. You pick this up particularly in verses 12 to 18, where Paul is talking about his imprisonment. But he's also talking about two groups of preachers that have emerged. Some are preaching Christ out of selfish ambition, and others are preaching Christ out of sincere love. Many of the evangelicals that I know would criticize the first and commend the second. Paul says, what does it matter? So long as Christ is preached. What he does not affirm is a preaching of a false gospel, by the way. These people are preaching a right gospel with a wrong motive. That's different from preaching a wrong gospel with a wrong motive. And what he says is, what does it matter? So long as Christ is preached, and if Christ is preached, that is the most important thing. And then, when he talks about his suffering in prison, from verse 18b down to the end, verse 26, you see this sense of the kingdom lens first again. In verse 18, he tells us that he expects to be free, but he isn't presuming that he will be free. In verse 20, he talks about life and death and the fact that he's in two minds about it all. It's hard to explain. The picture that I have of this encounter with him, with the Philippians in words, is this. Let's say, what's your name?
Anne-Marie.
Imagine I'm a friend of yours and you're having surgery on Wednesday. And I'm praying for you at home on Tuesday night. I might pray something like this. Lord, I know that you're able to heal Anne-Marie instantly. I know that you can touch her body and make her well and everything will be fine. But please would you guide the surgeon on Wednesday? It's that sense of language that Paul is using here. He is saying, I know that God can set me free. I know that I could live. I know that I could die. Actually, he says, I prefer to die and go and be with Christ immediately, which is far better. He had this profoundly strong sense of hope in heaven that held him. But I know that for your benefit, I need to stay and remain. So he has this ability to sit in the midst of various competing preaching schools or circuits, and in prison, and the uncertainty of his own life, and the weight of the churches, and everything else. How does he do that? What is it that links all of those approaches of life together in him? I think it is the profound sense that his whole life is lived for Christ. And I think I could summarize it in a statement he doesn't use, but I think it captures him. Do in my life whatever will further your kingdom. Whatever will bring greatest glory to your name, do in my life. Or let your kingdom come. Let your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. I don't know if you've ever been in a place where you've prayed that. Do in my life whatever will bring the greatest glory to your name. We have a son, I mentioned him last night, called Benjamin. He is now 23. He and his wife are expecting their first baby. Benjamin has a disorder similar to cystic fibrosis. He first took ill when he was 8 weeks. And has been on life support 16 or 17 times. He's doing really well now. But when he was about 10, we did all of his therapies at home. And he had come home, he had been in hospital for about a month. And he came home, and I have a habit of praying with the children every night, no matter where I am, even here on a phone or something. Even children, they're 25 down to 20 now, but, well, you know, they're still your children, aren't they? So on this particular occasion, I went in to see him. No, I'll tell you a funny story about this first, because it's a bit heavy. He's a big Chelsea supporter. So we wrote to the Chelsea football team, and they all sent back photographs signed for him to encourage him. And he was delighted about this. He was about 8 at the time. He'd only just begun to write clearly and well, you know. And a couple of days afterwards, he came downstairs with a brown envelope. And he gave it to me and he said, Dad, could you post that for me, please? I said, what is it? He said, just post it to the Chelsea Football Club. I said, well, what's in the envelope? He said, well, they all sent me photographs signed, so I thought I'd send them one back. Which I think is really fantastic. Anyway, when he was 10... he was tired. And I went into his room that night. We were living in Reading at the time. And I said, Benjamin, how do you want me to pray for you, son? And he said, I think I want you to pray that I go to heaven, Dad. Because I'm really tired. And I couldn't. I couldn't do that. I said, I can't pray that for you. And I realized, actually, for all my words, I don't have the grasp that Paul had. So I came out of his room and I slid down the wall and just sat outside saying, God, I can't let this boy go. And years later, just 2 years ago, after all of the deaths in the family, I said to the Lord one morning, I can't bury someone else that I love. Please, give me a space. I can't do it. And I don't hear the voice of God. I've heard something of God's voice twice in my life. I'll talk about that if you like, but only twice. But I had a sense of, not a voice of God, but just a prompting. And I felt as if the Lord spoke to me and said, Malcolm, you have already, your problem is this. The person that you are supposed to love the most has died and risen again. And you will never attend his funeral. The Lord Jesus. Your problem is you actually love everybody else in your family more than him. And when you get this right in your head, you will be able to bury anybody. Do you know why that is important to me? And I'm not saying this is true for you. That was like that moment outside Benjamin's bedroom. I didn't have this perspective that I'm talking to you about. I'm not sure that I always have it now, although I'm learning to have it. If push came to shove for Malcolm Duncan, I'm not saying it's true for you, I would have chosen my wife before God. I would have chosen my children before God. Because I had made them idols. There's nothing more countercultural in modern evangelicalism and Christianity than what I'm about to say to you. Anyone or anything that you cannot live without is an idol. The only person that a believer cannot live without is Jesus. But many of us have allowed our families, our spouses, people that we love to become idols. And we love them more than we would love God. We just don't tell anybody. And that's why when death visits us, it visits us with such ferocity. Because a core part of our worship structure is taken away. And the only answer to that is an answer that I cannot give you, but Paul gives us. And it is to reorder our lives and give Christ back the central place. And as a result, you love your children more. You love your husband, you love your wife, you love your family, you love your friends more. But as long as they are above Christ, you cannot love him properly. And when you let him take the ascendancy, you are given the power to love your family and those closest to you even more deeply. But it's one of the paradoxes of the kingdom that we can't get our heads around. So to redeem the trial, to find strength in the midst of it, we somehow need to remember that we're part of a community, and that involves vulnerability. It involves honesty, it involves dependency, it involves receiving as well as giving, it involves humility, it involves honesty, it involves the willingness to ask for help when you need it, it involves breaking down the barriers of isolation around you, it involves all of that. And to see the trial through the lens of God involves saying to God, do in my life whatever will bring greatest glory to your name. And it involves demolishing the idols that have gripped our souls and allowing Christ to be at the centre. And it involves remembering that the trial does not define you, but it can refine you. And you have the capacity to make a choice about that. I want to pray for you before we go for coffee. Would you by your Spirit? Speak into our souls. To speak of loss is to draw people into a room full of mirrors where they remember all their losses. And we open up the torn fragments of our soul before you, like ripped manuscripts. And we each have people who are missing from our lives today. There will be widows and widowers. There will be parents who have lost children, children who have lost parents, brothers who have lost sisters, sisters who have lost brothers, friends who have lost friends here today. There will be those struggling with illness, struggling with financial uncertainty. We are a community of the bedraggled and the broken. But we are a community. Thank you for your grace shown to us through others. Help us to receive it. And help us to share your grace with others. With a glance or a touch or a smile or a meal. Or a moment. And Lord, from the depths of our souls, however whispered and weak it might be, we say to you, do in our lives whatever will bring the greatest glory to your name. Amen. There'll be an opportunity to receive prayer. Later? Can we do that at the end of the next session, or do you want to do it now? It's up to you. You're leading the meeting. You do what you like.
I was just going to ask, please, is there going to be prayer ministry available now? The back of the room. Also, while I'm just looking at the back of the room, I see Louise. If you are a day visitor and you haven't paid yet, Louise will be chasing after you. So go and see Louise. Lovely. So we've got coffee and tea outside, so two different tables. We have syrup for the children, but it does need diluting. Grown-ups, you can also have the syrup, I'm sure, but remember to dilute it. We'll be meeting back here at 11:15. And just something to think about during the coffee break, if you're planning on doing a walk or some other activity this afternoon, if you're willing to invite others, let me know.
Give them an extra 10 minutes, 11:20.
Yes, it is. Yes, it's 5 to 11, so we'll meet back in half an hour at 11:25. And the children go directly to their groups, but you need to go home now. Okay.
It's